Hi everyone, this is Flo, not Indy as usual. I'm here for you to listen to the Great War Channel podcast, a side project to our YouTube channel where we interview historians, scholars who also work with World War I to give you a few additional perspectives that you might not get by just watching our show. And today I have a guest here from Berlin actually. We are in the studio in Berlin and he's Oliver and he's going to introduce himself to you now.
Yeah, I'm Oliver Jans. I'm a professor of modern history at the Freie University in Berlin. And I'm a specialist of World War I, also of, generally speaking, of 19th and 20th century German and Italian history. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming by. You now, just in the pre-recording, you actually said you're sometimes considered Mr. World War I.
Well, just here in Berlin, I would say, and maybe one of the experts in Germany, where the interest for World War I is not so high as in other countries, especially Anglo-Saxon countries like Great Britain and Australia, for instance.
Yeah. Is that something that changed in the centennial now?
Well, yes, there is in the younger generation we certainly have more younger scholars dealing again with the First World War, but in the older generation it's a sideshow, the First World War in German historiography. It was a great debate, of course, and a great theme in the 60s of the last 10 centuries with the Fischer debate. But and then in the 70s and 80s, there was a turn to everyday life and social history of the Great War. But the Great War never regained the importance it had in the 60s, when Fritz Fischer made his claim that Germany had planned the First World War for a long time and deliberately started the war. This was of course great news and highly debated because it meant that Germany not only started the Second World War, but that Hitler and the Second World War come from afar, so to speak, have a long history. So it was a debate on German history in general, modern German history in general.
It's a debate so big in Germany that even I, who didn't study history, know about it. And I think, I even knew about it before I started working for this channel. I think it's like, it's one of the classic public debates of German, like the German culture establishment, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, because it was about German history in general and German identity. And the question basically was Hitler just an incident, an accident in German history, or was it the culmination of a peculiar path in German history, and especially a path which led to imperialism and a special kind of nationalism and things like this. So it was about German identity.
Mm-hmm. For the centennial, I mean, there were a few important projects. One of the projects is one that you are working on right now, which is the digital encyclopedia of the First World War, which is an English language encyclopedia. So everybody who is listening can check it out. It has been a great overview source for us. Could you tell us a bit more about the project and how it came to be?
Yes, of course. The idea was to create a truly transnational and global encyclopedia of the First World War and make it accessible to really a large public and large audience. And the idea was born with some colleagues when we had a look at the existing encyclopedias, all of them in print, and They were like 5, 6, 7 years ago. There were basically, there was a French one, there was a German one, and there was an Italian version of the French one. And all these encyclopedias were A, in print and not online, and B, they were all imbued with national perspectives, so to speak. Not that they were nationalist in or nationalistic, but the authors mainly came from one country or from two or three usual suspect countries, and they were all, the content was also not global, I would say, and really comparative and transnational. And so our idea was, hey, we need something different. We need something more encompassing, more global, more transnational. We need really to get the people in. We need to write this encyclopedia not just from Berlin and Paris and Oxford and Harvard or so, but really to get the local competence in various countries and regions of the world. We need to bring that in. And so that was the basic idea. So we started to work on that project, and we went a long way. Now this is probably the biggest network in First World War studies in the world. We have 1,000 authors, editors, and external referees from more than 50 countries in the world. We have, since the launch in end of 2014, we have published more than 1,200 articles. Not only short entries on single persons or events, but also long handbook articles on entire countries or big themes like women's mobilization in war, things like this, or prisoners of war. And I guess it's not only the biggest network or publication of this kind. It would easily fill more than 35 volumes of an encyclopedia if you print it out. Yeah? It's not only the biggest enterprise in the field of First World War studies, maybe one of the biggest publication projects in the humanities as such in the world. Yeah.
And this global collaborative approach, mm-hmm. Do you maybe have one or two examples on how this played out in individual articles, or how it changed certain perspectives or preconceptions?
The idea was to regionalize certain themes. That means we have not just a long article on prisoners of war in general, but we have articles on prisoners of war in Germany and France and Great Britain and so on, Italy, but also Japan and or all the colonies. And that means you bring in very diverse and hitherto unknown perspectives in. There have been German prisoners in Japan, for instance, during the First World War, or German prisoners taken in the colonies, which then have been brought to Australia. You get, when you do things like this, go really in depth, then you get a very diverse picture, and you can really compare the experiences, for instance, of prisoners of war, or other groups, and as you may know, they have been treated very differently in different countries, and not only treated differently in different countries, different groups of prisoners have been treated differently in one country, like say Germany or Austria. for many reasons. So a highly complex, such a highly complex theme needs really, this comparative approach, and you need specialists from many countries. So I guess we have more than 20 articles only on prisoners of war. And, always a general overview article which tries to bind that, to wrap that all up, of course. Mm-hmm.
And
maybe another example of where we clearly go beyond what the current state of affairs is that we also, and this was not planned from the beginning, I have to say, this came with on the road, was that we look at neutral countries. The neutrals have been for a long time overlooked in the history of the in First World War studies, because First World War studies have been focused very much on military and political, purely political aspects. And if you look at societies on economy, you immediately see that a country like Spain or Denmark is highly affected economically, but also in terms of society by the First World War. For instance, Denmark mobilized a huge amount of soldiers. They never went to war, but since Denmark expected either an attack by Germany or a landing by allied British, mainly troops, they mobilized their army, and they mobilized the whole society. And this meant the men were absent from families, like in belligerent countries, and you have very similar consequences. Of course, they did not die. This is, of course, an important difference, but, you know, this is things like this. So we have a whole section now on Denmark alone, a whole section on Sweden alone, on Spain, Netherlands, Switzerland alone. We have like 20 articles on Switzerland, for instance, and
We also started covering a lot of the neutral countries per request from our fans in different episodes. And Denmark is a case where you can see the consequences by still seeing that they were basically at peace. But I mean, if you look at other countries like Albania or Persia, which were neutral, but definitely were not neutral in terms of like how they were perceived, and I mean there was armed forces and fighting even.
Absolutely, but the same is true for the United States. Neatly separate the history of the United States during the First World War in the face of neutrality and belligerence is misleading in a way, because the country was involved in the war much before April 1917 in many ways. I mean, there were volunteers, there were fighting for France and so on. There were nurses and medical personnel employed voluntarily. But the whole society was kind of mobilized and shaken by the debate on whether to remain neutral or not. And you have the enemy alien problem much before April 17. And financially and economically, one cannot say that the United States have been really neutral. I mean, J.P. Morgan succeeded in bearing the access to Germans to Wall Street, the British, the Entente, they had access to Wall Street, and this is a huge difference. Yeah.
And you said in the beginning that it should be the project, the encyclopedia, should not just be something that is work accessible by academics or scholars, but that is also something that is accessible to the public. How difficult was it, I mean, considering the scope you just described, to make such a project accessible for someone who's maybe just interested in quotation marks in the war?
Well, we're working under the open access paradigm from the beginning, because we have public, they're funded by German Research Council, which means this is public money. So so open access, that's given. We do not charge anything. So that means that that makes it highly accessible, and we have more than 3 million had more than 3 million visitors since the start. But if your question is how do we bridge the gap between academic content and a wider audience, that was your question. It is our ambition is to give or to publish the valid, academically or scientifically valid information, state-of-the-art research. That is our ambition, and But this we achieve this by evaluating every article in a two-step process. So it's every article is refereed two times. But at the same time, traditional academic publishing, usually in print especially, does not do, because it's not possible. We enrich the content with images, with external links to resources in the web. Not necessarily academic resources, but say, simply sources. And we also link the articles among them, of course, in order that you can navigate semantically. Yeah, you don't have to read the whole article. You can, like in Wikipedia, you can navigate from one sentence to a sentence with a similar content in another article, which is much more the way young people take in information today.
Yeah.
So all this makes it certainly does not turn it into a popular project, but it makes it interesting for not only scholars or university students. And we have enthusiastic feedback from high school teachers all from Canada, from the US, all over the world, who say, I use this resource with my students in high schools, and so that proves in a way that this works.
Yeah. And all the articles you publish, of course, have a bibliography in the end, so people can expand their reading if they want to, their sources mentioned and everything.
Yes, we have every article goes with a bibliography, and the bibliography of every article, the bibliographies are accumulated in a system which is called Zotero, so that you have, and now we have like 9,000 items in our bibliography, and you can search that and filter by languages, by themes, and you can say, give me all books and entries in Japanese. Yeah, and this makes it, of course, highly usable, I would say. Mm-hmm.
So here's a bit of a mean question. Do you have a favorite article?
Well, my own, of course.
Which one would that be?
It's apart from the introduction, it's an article on commemoration and mourning in Italy after the First World War, during and after the First World War. This was, of course, a joke. Certainly not the best article in the encyclopedia. I like the articles on the hitherto neglected subjects in general, because this is our strong point. But there are so many that I would not like really to name one. I mean, just have a look at it, and you will find so many that you will immediately grasp what I mean. Yeah.
Is it difficult? I mean, you said in the beginning the First World War here in Germany, for example, is a topic which is not so popular. I would assume that this is the case in other countries too. That might also only be, you know, tangibly part of the war. Is it difficult to research these topics, of often neglected topics, even like basically the niche within a niche kind of topics?
Well, it's we have problems with certain themes. For instance, the economic history of the First World War is under research. It has been researched quite a lot back in the 60s and one has to say in the 20s of the 20th century, but it in the last decade has been certainly neglected. But usually it's amazing how in say countries like Japan or the Netherlands or Switzerland, which you would presume these are countries where you don't find specialists. There are specialists. We have found them. Of course, not for every. There are open articles, and you will find we have a call for articles and call for authors. By the way, you will find the articles where we have difficulties to find authors. They are listed.
I will put a link to that in the description of the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. And people can flag if they want to write an article we are looking author for. They can also suggest new articles. Yeah. So, and this is how very often we are enriching the content by these proposals, basically. And
Has there been you mentioned neutral countries? Have there been other topics which you didn't have on your radar when you started the project that you just got your attention when people more and more people were suggesting them?
Yes. Generally speaking, I mean, we started with the idea that this is a global war, but at the beginning. We put the White Dominions together in one box, and then we learned that there's so much research to be done there, and so much content that we have to create single sections for. But also for Africa, we started with the idea, well, let's make one section just Africa or something like this, and then this became bigger and bigger and more important on the way because different regions in Africa have been affected quite differently. You have very different research networks dealing with these regions. So again, here we have enlarged this, and also the countries like Malaysia or Thailand, or which we didn't have on our radar, certainly China as well was a issue here, and so certainly the global dimension is much bigger now than India, of course, than it was in our original plan.
Mm. Now that's something that also clicked for us. I mean, it's called a world war. But I mean, if you look at past popular media approaches and everything, it certainly doesn't feel like it sometimes.
Exactly. The latest new section we are creating is on the centenary of the First World War itself. So it's a public history section, if you want. It's a whole section with, say, we'll have 50, 60 long articles. On the way, this global war is remembered today in the years of the centenary, and we will have articles on every relevant country, not only the big ones, but also on themes, on different media, on the centenary in the internet. for instance, what we are doing here. Yeah,
yeah, basically.
Because this is probably the first big historical anniversary, which is also to a great degree done, so to speak, in the internet or present in the internet. I can't think of any other big anniversary which had such an important internet dimension, so to speak. And this turns it into a paradigm or an example or a forerunner or a first case, so to speak, a laboratory, because other big anniversaries, say, whatever, 100 years, Second World War, will certainly be present in the internet to an even greater degree in the future.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We are recording this now in December 2017. Mm-hmm. Next year is 2018, so it's the centennial of what officially is always considered the end of the First World War, the end year, because of the armistice on the Western Front. But I mean, if you look at the events after November 1918, they didn't live happily ever after. So how are you going to deal with? With these kinds of events.
I get it. Yeah. We are considering and have considered this war right from the start, not only as a global war, but also as a long war, or as not as the Great War only, but as a greater war, as some colleagues call it. That means that really from the global or not Western European perspective. So one thing is connected to the other. The 1918 is not the end of the First World War. I mean, of course, formally it is, and there was a armistice with the Ottoman Empire in October 1918. Of course, formally speaking, the First World War ended there as well. But this is a very formal way to look at it. It's, as you know, for Russia or Eastern Europe, October, November 1918 is not a seizure. It's the revolution on the one hand, and then the end of the Civil War, comes much later. So there is a continuum between the First World War and the Civil War, of course. And the Civil War cost more lives than the First World War, even to Russia. And for the whole Near and Middle East, again, the same argument is true. It's the war goes on in the form, not so much of a civil war, but a regional wars between the new Turkish Republic and Armenia and Greece and against the Western allies, of course. And again, millions die, and this has been overlooked for so many times. But Ireland is another case. No, even in Western Europe, the war goes on, the War of Independence, and in Ireland which, by the way, results in Great Britain losing probably more territory than Germany in the First World War, is another case in point. So how are we dealing with? We have one-sixth of our content is devoted to what we call post-war, dealing with all these aspects, not only the wars after the war, the conflicts of the war, the peace treaties, but also the economic consequences, the social consequences. Just think of the welfare schemes which have emerged after the First World War. I mean, really, the welfare state has made a great leap forward because of the Great War, because you had all these victims, traumatized orphans and mutilated people and so on and so forth. We have to deal with social consequences, internal upheaval, revolutions. Of course, somewhere you have to stop, otherwise you would turn it into an encyclopedia of the 20th century, which it is not. Of course, we have an article on Hitler, but because he
He fought in the war.
He fought in the war, but somewhere in the 20s, I mean, somewhere we end. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this will probably also give us a lot of material to think about, because, I mean, you know, obviously the channel is also approaching the magical November 11th date, and we will have to think about how to wrap it up and where to. So I will definitely check out the post-war section. I recommend everybody of our fans to check out the encyclopedia. What Oliver said, if you're an expert in a topic, or if you know someone who is an expert, and there's always an open call for authors and for papers. And
well, there and we're working on even more ways to make the project more collaborative more interactive. Yeah. So far, it was a little bit top down, so to speak, a classical academic project. We will very soon, there will be a comment function, and comments, of course, can lead to versionizing of articles that you know, if the comments are make sense, and if they contain some constructive critique, and then the author of the article will have to take that in, and maybe will be asked to publish a second version. By the way, versions will all be kept, will all remain accessible, and there will even be a track changes function. You're already able to track changes between different versions of the same article. And there will be a My Encyclopedia function very soon, which means you can customize a little bit the content for you. You can create a section for your own purpose, download material, and create a workspace, so to speak. Maybe, well, this is an ideal function for a working group or a course, in university seminar or course. For teachers who can build on the basis of the encyclopedia really their own environment, and there will also be a blog function where people can post whatever information is relevant to the encyclopedia. Yeah.
And the articles and all the information that is there is not just accessible in terms of a web page. People can also download it in various reader formats, so that it might be more suitable for reading on the go.
Oh, that's already possible. Yeah. Of course, you can download every article as a PDF and in other formats as well. That's already.
I'm glad that you say, of course, that's possible, but I'm sure there's plenty of other platforms which won't allow that. So that I wanted to point that out. If you, for example, have an e-reader or something, you can also enjoy your articles there.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, Oliver. I think this was very enlightening. We highly recommend the project. It's a great addition to the topics we cover in the show. Definitely check it out. And keep an eye on the changes Oliver just described. So thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.